It's Thursday, December 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Iraqi forces find more Islamic State pockets of resistance in Ramadi. We look back at this year's blockbuster exhibit in New York on China's cultural influences.
The fact that there is this long tradition of imagining China in the West, sometimes it's more fantasy than reality, makes it clear that the West is still struggling to come to a deeper appreciation and understanding of what Chinese culture and what Chinese civilization is all about.
And we hear some New Year's resolutions. It's all ahead. Days after raising the Iraqi flag over the provincial capital of Ramadi, Iraqi security forces say pockets of resistance of Islamic State fighters, in numbers ranging from a few dozen to several hundred, still pose a risk in and near the city. The city, devastated by U.S.-led airstrikes and months of IS occupation, is riddled with booby traps and IEDs, improvised explosive devices. The UN estimates it will take $20 million to rebuild the shattered city and resettle its residents. Ambassador James Jeffrey, a veteran diplomat posted to Baghdad and Ankara and now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, was recently in Iraq, and he tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he's not surprised by the destruction but believes Ramadi can make a rapid comeback.
We've seen this before in battles such as Tikrit and to some degree Beji, which go back and forth. This city is primarily under the control of Iraqi forces at this point. They have a huge numerical superiority. They hold terrain, and only a small percent of their forces are good in attacking ISIS. Most of the forces in there can hold terrain once they've gotten in there. So they're just going to continue squeezing the ISIS people, and they will eventually be driven out.
This is a city that has been devastated after months of occupation. It's going to take a long time to rebuild the city. Thousands of homes reportedly destroyed.
That's true, and that's part of what we're all going to have to deal with ISIS. I was just out in Iraq, and just the cost of keeping people mobilized and keeping refugees housed is costing Iraq, both Kurdistan in the north and the central government in the south, easily $10 billion a year. So destroying ISIS, even if a lot of cities are damaged in the process, is financially cheaper, totally apart from all of the other moral and military and other benefits of it. It's cheaper. I mean, there is no choice. There's no way to destroy these guys without blowing up a lot of buildings, because they, frankly, a lot of the buildings they blow up themselves, no matter how careful the U.S. military is, they wire all of the buildings, or at least most of them. And here's the other thing, Victor. You know, I went into Fallujah a few months after the Marines took it house by house, and most of the city was functioning and back in operation. Now, ISIS may be doing a better job of blowing up buildings as they retreat, a scorched earth policy, but still, I was very impressed with what Fallujah looked like a few months after we went in and took that thing house by house, with a lot of artillery, a lot of air, and a lot of tank fire.
Prime Minister Abadi pledged to retake Mosul 400 kilometers north of Baghdad by next year. Is that overly optimistic?
If the U.S. does not further increase its direct engagement, both in quality, that is the kind of forces we're using, where we're using them, and in quantity, I don't think that's possible. And even then, it's going to be hard because we won't have the same offensive forces. We basically rely primarily on the counterterrorism force in Ramadi and on certain elite units of the Peshmerga in Sinjar. And the Peshmerga really cannot be all that effective in non-Kurdish areas, and most of Mosul is non-Kurdish. And this is one reason why I think that some use of American forces is necessary.
James Jeffrey of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. But Ahmed Ali, a senior fellow at the Institute of Regional and International Studies at American University of Iraq, is quoted by the Associated Press as saying the strategy that won back Ramadi shows Iraqis, backed by coalition airstrikes, are ready to fight. And he says calls for U.S. ground troops are not the best strategy moving forward. Well, looking at social media today, you might happen to know, is New Year's Eve. On Twitter, there are more than 700,000 1,000 tweets under hashtag Happy New Year. Many offer greetings, others hope for 2016. We'll have more on the holiday coming up later on the program. In other news, South Korea and Japan reached an agreement this week on the issue of systematic abduction and sexual slavery by the Japanese Imperial Army during the Second World War. The government-sponsored program affected up to 200,000 victims throughout Asia, as well as Dutch and Australian women. While both sides agreed to consider the issue irreversibly resolved, experts in Washington say such rosy scenario is unlikely. James Person is the deputy director of the Wilson Center's History and Public Policy Program. He spoke with my colleague G. Abby Lee, who asked him how the agreement would impact relations between the neighboring countries.
Although Korea and Japan have maintained economic and security relations, I expect the greatest improvement to be in political relations.
Many in South Korea have expressed, including the surviving victims, that the agreement is not one that reflects national interests or, more importantly, just. What are your thoughts on that?
There are three things that should be viewed positively. For one, it's reaffirming one of the key findings of the Kono Statement of 1993. One thing that, in fact, has been questioned by Japanese officials, even as recently as this year, and that is the complicity or the involvement of the Japanese military, both in setting up and then maintaining these so-called comfort stations. That Prime Minister Kishida, admitted this, I think is a good thing. It's a positive thing. Also, we see Prime Minister Abe expressing anew his sincere apologies in his capacity as Prime Minister of Japan. And finally, we see that the government of Japan has agreed to take measures with its own budget.
You said earlier that this is not the ideal situation. So in your opinion, what more could have been done?
I wish more were done to actually address this ongoing problem of Japan not doing more to instill in society a real sense of contrition. This is through education. You see this through textbooks, for example, where you have these revisionist accounts in textbooks that are vetted and approved by the government that whitewash the legacy of Imperial Japan. We see also government officials come out and negate statements. No one is arguing that there haven't been apologies in the past. There were. The problem is, as soon as an apology is issued, someone else comes out and negates that apology.
Thank you so much for your insight today.
Sure.
That's James Person. He's a Washington-based researcher, and he was speaking with International Edition's G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
For those of us with a serious sweet tooth, it can be really difficult to resist treats like candy, cake, and cookies.
Sugar.
But diabetes, heart disease, and obesity, which are associated with eating sugary foods, are at or near record levels. So it's important not to overindulge on those sweet goodies. Scientists don't know all the specific physical drivers that trigger our sugar cravings, but new research has found a hormone that actually quashes the intake of some simple sugars. A group of scientists conducting studies on mice found that the mouse liver produces a sugar-suppressing hormone called fibroblast growth factor 21 in response to high levels of carbohydrates. Once in the bloodstream, the hormone tells the mouse brain to reduce its fondness for sweets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, singer Selena Gomez has a new album as she battles health challenges. This year witnessed one of the most popular shows ever at New York City's Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Costume Institute's exhibit, China Through the Looking Glass, began in May and was extended 3 weeks through Labor Day at the end of the summer. I spoke in September with Maxwell K. Hearn, Douglas Dillon, Chairman of Asian Art at the Met.
The exhibit is actually one of the largest, if not the largest, museum exhibitions ever mounted by the museum, because it occupies something like 30,000 square feet. It's taken over virtually all of the Chinese galleries in the museum for the permanent collection, as well as the permanent galleries for the Costume Institute, and even one small space in the Egyptian wing, so that we are spread out across three floors. And so it's really a vast undertaking. So just from the point of view of scale alone, it is a very grand undertaking.
Yes, I had the privilege of visiting, and I don't recall I've ever been to a Met exhibit that was on three floors like that before.
We wanted to tie the show together. The concept behind the show is to present the inspiration that China has provided to Western designers across several centuries, beginning with chinoiserie in the 17th and 18th century and coming right down to the present. And we felt it would be very meaningful to place these costumes within the Chinese galleries to juxtapose works of art from the Chinese collections with these Western fashions, to really make the point that various ways of in which Western designers have taken, drawn inspiration from Chinese traditional art.
And it was very striking seeing not only the costumes, but the use of film and music. It really combined a number of media. It was really quite striking.
The premise of the exhibition, which was curated by Andrew Bolton from the Costume Institute, but which we were very happy to collaborate with him and bring the expertise of our Chinese specialists to bear on the show, was that China has been a source of inspiration, starting with export fabrics and blue and white ceramics, and then subsequently, as museum collections developed in the West, these collections became a source of inspiration. And finally, in the 30s and later, cinema was a very important source of giving people an impression about what Chinese life or Chinese fashion was all about. So it became a very significant part of the exhibition to choose films starting in the 1930s that portrayed China either by Western filmmakers or subsequently by Chinese filmmakers themselves.
And a prominent film in the exhibit is some of the sound and some of the film from The Last Emperor.
Yes, so the exhibition begins with a series of galleries that present three ages of Chinese culture. The Imperial Age, which is typified by the dragon robe of the Qing Dynasty emperors. The Republican Era, which is typified by the Qi Pao, which is a very slender, close-fitting dress for women. And finally, the Maoist Era, where the Mao suit became the one fashion that unified all of China, and which in turn had its impact on Western designers. So those three ages are really set forth in the opening sections of the exhibition.
And why do you think this exhibit has been so successful? It was extended for 3 weeks.
I think that China is a subject that people are fascinated by. We recognize that China has become politically and economically a major force on the world stage today, but that there's still a need for us to understand its culture. And the fact that there is this long tradition of imagining China in the West, sometimes it's more fantasy than reality, makes it clear that the West is still struggling to come to a deeper appreciation and understanding of what Chinese culture and what Chinese civilization is all about. But the very fact that China is such a prominent part of the show, I think, has made it enormously popular, not to mention the fact that the dresses themselves are so sumptuous and beautiful. It's clear that people find that very easy to relate to.
That's Maxwell K. Hearn. He's Douglas Dillon, Chairman of Asian Art at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London now joins International Edition's Ira Melman for a look at singer Selena Gomez's new album and at some of her personal challenges.
Today on International Edition, we are once again joined by VOA's own Larry London, host of Border Crossings. Who are we talking about today, Larry?
Well, Ira, thank you for asking. We're talking about Selena Gomez. A lot of people have been talking about Selena Gomez this past year. It's been a very, very busy year for Selena. She has released her latest album, which is her second solo album, and the album's called Revival. And she used to record with a band called The Scene and had three albums with that band. But this is the second as a solo performer. She announced earlier this year that she's been diagnosed with lupus. She was undergoing some treatment for that. She's a celebrity spokesperson for UNICEF, a worldwide ambassador for UNICEF, among the many things that she does. And, of course, she has been linked to Justin Bieber on and off this past year as well.
Sorry to hear that. But
yeah,
other than that, she's had a pretty long, good career.
She's had a great career. She was a voice character in the animated film Hotel Transylvania 2. She has another film coming out in 2016 with Paul Rudd. So she's keeping her film career going. She's working on her music. And she has a new single out. But most recently, in this last week alone, Latina Magazine named Selena Gomez the second most influential Latina on social media this past year, just behind Shakira.
What kind of progression has she had as a performer?
Well, she started off on a kid's show. She used to act alongside of Demi Lovato on Barney and Friends when she was only 6 years old. And throughout her career, she was on the Disney Channel. She acted on a popular TV show on the Disney Channel and then launched a singing career. And probably wasn't taking it seriously when she did. But lo and behold, her music took foot and a lot of people flocked to hear her and see her. And so, as is the case with many of these Disney stars, she's now become a pop star, bona fide pop star.
But she owes it all to Barney, of course, the purple dinosaur.
That's right. Yes. She owes it all for Barney. He's probably on tour with her. But her new single is called Hands to Myself from her album Revival. She says the album is a revival of herself. She's gone through some, you know, self-image issues in the last year. There were a lot of haters on social media calling her heavy, overweight. She said, hey, give me a break. I've got lupus. The medication caused weight gain. She's had some other issues along the way. Of course, the very public relationship with Justin Bieber, as I mentioned. But she announced that in 2016, she's going out on tour. May 6th is opening night at the Mandalay Bay Casino Resort in Las Vegas.
Good for her.
Here's her new song. This is called Hands to Myself, Selena Gomez.
Larry London. Thanks, Larry.
Can't keep my hands to myself. No matter how hard I'm trying to, I want you all to myself. You're metaphorical gin and juice, so come on, give me a taste of what it's like to be next to you. Won't let one drop go to waste. You're metaphorical gin and juice.
That is the music of Selena Gomez. Well, at midnight today, Thursday, December 31st, Americans and many others around the world will be ushering in a brand new year. On the National Mall here in Washington, locals and visitors alike shared with VOA some of their hopes and resolutions for 2016.
The world becomes a better place and my family becomes better too.
It just seems like everyone's so angry all the time, and we need to find peace again within ourselves.
Peace for all the world. My parents is back home in Afghanistan. I wish I can break them here. Having a healthy life.
Get better grades.
Travel more, work less. That's right. Get healthy, so spend more time walking and spending more time with family.
Get better at karate.
Lose a little bit of weight, gain some more muscle, and, you know, become a better person.
Be healthy. Peace.
Our show, please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us and have a very happy new year.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the terrible attacks carried out by Boko Haram in Nigeria, December 25th to 28th, as well as other recent attacks in Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. In these attacks, Boko Haram killed dozens of innocent people who were targeted as they went about their daily lives, attending service at a mosque, shopping in a neighborhood market, or simply traveling down a road. We extend our deepest condolences to the families and loved ones of the victims, and we stand with the people of Nigeria and the region in the fight against Boko Haram. Boko Haram has no regard for human life. Its vicious attacks against the innocent, including women and children, and its use of children as human bombs prove its true nature as a purveyor of hate and terror. Although Boko Haram may be able to kill innocent people, it cannot succeed in imposing its will on the people of Nigeria and the other countries of the Lake Chad Basin. The people of this region are not cowed by Boko Haram. They continue to demonstrate remarkable resilience and unshaken resolve in living their lives as they work, take care of their families, and go about day-to-day living. The United States remains committed to helping Nigeria and its neighbors counter Boko Haram's senseless acts of terror. Despite much progress over the past year, due in large part to newly bolstered Nigerian and regional efforts, more work remains to ensure the people of Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria can live in peace. The conflict has affected the lives of communities across the Lake Chad Basin region, with some 2.5 million internally displaced people and more than 170,000 Nigerian refugees forced to flee their homes. The United States provides advisors, intelligence, training, logistical support, and equipment to our African partners as they work to defeat Boko Haram. We also support those affected by Boko Haram's violence through ongoing humanitarian aid and victim support services. The United States will continue working with our partners in the region to identify new opportunities to support their efforts to stop Boko Haram's wanton violence and restore order in the Lake Chad Basin region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.